So today, I'm going to do something very simple. I'm going to show you, well, not really, but how special relativity sort of follows from Maxwell's theory. And so it could have been discovered already in the 1860s when Maxwell formulated Maxwell's theory. All right, but before we do that, so really, Maxwell's theory, which we are studying so far, has so many remarkable properties that it's a cornerstone of modern physics. So Maxwell's theory, we have already seen some of them, and you will see some more later on. But it has, so many gadgets, so many symmetries, so many nice properties. So one of them, which we already seen, is that it is a gauge theory. Well, we know that, of course, gauge theory. All modern theories are gauge theories, and it's like really a great discovery that these gauge theories have been, discovered. It is also a conformal field theory. So it's a theory which does not care about scales, and it's, because the photon is massless, that's an indication that this might be the case. So I'm not really telling you what conformal symmetry means, but basically, if you rescale the metric by an arbitrary factor, meaning I can, scale my distances whatever I want, then actually the field equations behave nicely for the Maxwell's theory. In fact, the field strength will not change under that. And so really, this is a beautiful symmetry. And of course, this is the first thing. Well, we will have another course later on ADS CFT. So this is a Maxwell theory is the simplest CFT you can think about. Well, the most familiar CFT you can think about. Okay, it has also a beautiful electromagnetic duality. That's also, a super nice symmetry if you want. So if you have absence of sources, so in the case when rho is zero and j is zero, then you can observe that your source-free Maxwell equations have the symmetry where you can put e to b and b to minus e, and your Maxwell equations remain unchanged. And so that's called electromagnetic duality. It's really, I can exchange electric to magnetic fields. But this duality is actually much more than, as typically presented, as this thing here. Actually, this duality is already a symmetry of the Lagrangian. But of course, the Lagrangian is not written in terms of E and B, but rather, as we shall see, it's written in terms of the vector potentials phi and a. So actually there's a corresponding transformation of phi and a, which leaves the action invariant. And of course, by Noether theorem, there will be a conserved charge and so on, conserved current. So this is a really, really deep duality. And interestingly, if you look at linear Einstein equations, then the same duality is present there as well. So if you so so you know also for the linear Einstein theory, the same type of duality is present. And so if you are interested in this, there was a talk at PI, probably double N, Hanno. So he gave a talk here at PI about this electromagnetic duality, how to do it at the Lagrangian level, how to extend it to gravity, how to extend it to higher dimensions, and so on. So you'll see the talk, and you can find it on Pirsa. And finally, of course, it is relativistic. And so that was not immediately realized, that it really breaks the Galilean, symmetry, and instead it has the Lorentz symmetry. But what we already seen is that, in particular, it predicts the speed of light, predicts the existence of the speed of light, and this very fact is inconsistent with Galilean symmetry. Okay, so now I will concentrate on this last point here. So the very fact that you have some kind of speed, which is important, immediately sort of, you know, causes the fact that you can imagine your space-time, right? So before that, you had time, which has you know, units of seconds and so on. But then you also have spatial dimensions, which have units of meters and so on. But once you have some kind of speed, meters per second, you can actually convert time to dimensions of meters as well. And so this is really something that allows you to really image space-time. So image chance of space-time. This looks very formidable and very whatever. But all I mean at this point is that, you know, I can combine CT to form new coordinates, x mu, which would be, so I take the time, which now I convert with this velocity c to dimensions of length, and then I have my usual coordinates, xi. Okay, so we immediately, you know, have space-time coordinates, not only spatial coordinates and time, but now we have space-time coordinates here. And so, as Neil Turok says, well, so what is the notation here is typically, you know, the space-time indices are written in terms of the Greek letters, and the spatial indices are written in terms of the Latin letters, Latin indices like I, J, and whatever. Right? And so as Neil Turok, our former director, says, well, this is a proof that actually Greeks were infinitely more clever than Romans, right? Because they already knew about the space-time, whereas Romans only cared about space, okay? So similarly, you know, introducing these coordinates here, you can also introduce the derivative with respect to these coordinates. And it's, of course, d over d dt, and then d xi. Okay, so, you know, I'll in most of the applications, I will set c equal to 1. After all, that's what we predicted. C equal to 1. So then you would just wouldn't have the C here, and you wouldn't have the C here. But remember that, you know, having the C actually, in principle, allows you to convert these things into the right dimensions. All right. So now you can introduce the metric tensor for Minkowski space-time. And of course, that was done by Minkowski, and Einstein didn't like it at the beginning. But then he realized that this is really, you know, the way forward. So why not to introduce it? So we have, you know, Minkowski metric and for the time being, it's just, you know, a helpful tool for us. So it will be four-dimensional matrix, which is symmetric in the two indices. And it's just minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and then 0 everywhere else, where these minus 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 are on the diagonal. Okay. It's also useful to introduce the inverse matrix. So eta minus 1, alpha beta. So now the notation is that people do not write this minus 1. They just write eta with this indices upstairs, alpha beta. So this is the same thing as eta alpha beta. And then what is the inversion of this matrix? Well, it's the same matrix. Minus 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, and 0. And these two are really inverse in the sense that eta alpha beta, eta gamma, delta gamma alpha. So it's just an definition of the inverse matrix. Okay, So then we will also have objects which, you know, have some indices. So at this point, we just see the coordinates which have index upstairs, and we see the derivative which has index downstairs. Okay. So now, more generally, you can just say, you know, that there will be an object. Let's call it A, or let's call it V. With index upstairs, we will call that object a vector. And there will be an object which has index downstairs, and we'll call it covector. Because it looks like a vector, but it's not quite a vector. It has index down. But having the metric, it allows you basically to map vectors to covectors and vice versa. So you can always rise or lower indices, rise and lower indices with eta and eta inverse, right? So for example, if, you know, starting with omega mu, I can define nu omega mu to be eta mu nu omega nu, for example. Or I can define v mu to be eta mu nu v nu, like that. So basically using that metric, I can put the index up or put the index down, whatever I want. It's so simple and so nice. Okay, so finally, let me also notice is that, you know, we have this important operator box, which was minus d square dt square plus lambda square. So now if you stare at this, you immediately realize that you can write it as eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. Right, so that minus here, or the minus one here, just, you know, stands in front of dt square, and the plus stands in front of the spatial part. So similarly, you can also write that in terms of, you know, as this thing here, where this is a strange object. It's a derivative is index up, so the index of the derivative was raised with the metric, with the inverse metric. Okay, so that's the same thing. So of course, again, we are using the Einstein summation convention. We are summing over all possible indices alpha here. We are not writing the sum. And, you know, the indices which you sum over, as always, are called dummy indices. Okay. The indices which are free, so for example, if you look at this expression here, so you have an index which is, you know, not summed over. It's the important index, mu. And so, okay, so that's the free index, whereas the one here, the new index, is summed over, and that's the dummy index. All right. Questions so far? Who hasn't seen special relativity? So this is super simple, right? So let's just, okay. Let me go very quickly over this. So now we want to, you know, rewrite Maxwell theory in this new language. So that's our goal. So goal is to rewrite Maxwell's theory in the new language, this new language. And then, you know, if we achieve that, and we can write it in terms of, you know, vector equations and whatever, four vector equations, then that will sort of immediately prove that actually Maxwell's theory has Lorentz symmetry rather than the Galilean symmetry. Okay, so the crucial step in this is that you define a four vector A mu, which is just combination of what we call the electrostatic potential and what we call the vector potential. So that's the first step, and basically everything follows from there. Okay. So then, you know, with this definition, if you want, you can show that many of the properties of the Maxwell theory immediately follow from here. And many of the equations of Maxwell theory actually rewrite much more nicely in this four-vector language. Okay. So let me start with the Lorentz gauge condition. Lorentz T or no T Lorentz condition. So Lorentz condition was written as dt phi plus the divergence of A equals to zero. So now if you start at this, you see that you can also write it as d mu A mu equals to zero. That's much easier to remember. So similarly, we had some gauge transformations. So so we knew that the Maxwell theory was invariant under this type of change, and then A plus gradient of lambda, where lambda was an arbitrary function. So now this thing here can easily be written it can be written as, well, first I define, well, not define, I calculate a mu with index downstairs. So I lower the index with the Minkowski metric. So what it does is that the first component will pick up a minus sign, and the rest will not change. So it's minus phi n a. Okay, and then I can write my gauge transformation as a mu plus d mu of lambda, and that's basically captures these two transformations. Well, the first one is tricky, right? So I have minus phi goes to minus phi plus dt of lambda, which is this thing, up to a minus sign. You can also define what you mean by four current, k mu. Again, you combine rho and j. What else you could do, right? So that's your sources. And then you can easily show that your wave equations for phi and for a are written in this very nice form, minus 4 pi j mu. That's your two sets of wave equations for phi and for a. And also the potentials which we derived yesterday, the retarded potentials can be written in a nice form as V3R prime J mu D minus R minus R prime divided by R minus R prime. So you combine the sources rho and J, and this is your, that was the climax of yesterday's lecture, right? So we derive these retarded potentials.
Are we missing a minus sign somewhere? Because the contraction of the partial with a mu equals zero is not, is missing a minus sign.
Sorry, which one? Are you talking about the gauge transformations? The Lorentz gauge.
Find like that in the first part. I think there is a minus sign.
A mu. Oh no! I was so playing with the signs. So certainly, if it's written like this, it's written like that, right? You are saying there should be a minus sign. I'm not sure. Is that true?
Either on the potential or on the partial derivatives.
What did I tell you? No.
I don't think that's Because you...
No. The Lorentz gauge is this one. This is right, Lorentz gauge. There's no minus sign. Look at your notes. I'm just checking my notes, and it seems like this is the Lorentz gauge. More questions?
The box of AMU is for electrostatics only, statics only, like no dynamics.
So this box here is the wave operator, right? Is that box there? So if you had electrostatics, there wouldn't be time, but right? And so then you are breaking Lorentz invariant, sort of.
So this is like telling us that phi double dot is minus rho.
So this is the wave equation which we were solving yesterday. We were solving this equation for phi, right? So just for the zero component of a mu. We had box on phi is for pi rho here. And so that was the equation which we were solving yesterday. And there was another equation for a, right? Which I said, well, it looks exactly the same, so the solution will be the same, right? So yeah. But that's the full equation. That's the full Maxwell equation in the Lorentz gauge. So now you can write really, you know, your Maxwell equations are written as d mu a mu equals to 0, and box a mu is minus 4 pi j mu. That's your Maxwell equation. Okay? So you know, it's now very compact and very nice, right? More questions? Okay. Why don't we keep going in this direction? So we also had, you know, written Maxwell theory in terms of E and B. Right, that was the field strength, and so E and B, so for example E was minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt, and then B was curl of A, right? So this is what we had. So basically, what you need to know is that E and B are formed by taking a derivative of your vector phi, well, of a and then phi, right? So it looks like that. So it's very reasonable that, you know, e and b somehow should correspond to d of a, right? So okay, let me put the indices. So I'll have d alpha. Let's put this one here. Okay, so something like this, it has to happen, right? If it's, you know, to be Lorentz invariant. But now you see immediately a problem, right? So the problem is that, you know, there's four indices of these and four indices of these. So in principle, there's 16 components here. Okay? It's a tensor, basically, you know, 16 components. Well, that's too many, right? All we need to capture is E and B. There's 3 and 3, so we need to capture 6. Right, but now we have 16 if we just do this. So fortunately, you know, every tensor, let's call this tensor T alpha beta. So every tensor can be decomposed into its symmetric and antisymmetric part. So you can always write, for any tensor T alpha beta, you can write it as T alpha beta symmetrized. So this is like a symmetric part, yeah, symmetrizing over alpha and beta. These brackets mean symmetrization. And then plus d alpha beta antisymmetrization. Okay, so again, what I mean by this is d alpha beta symmetric is just 1/2 d alpha beta plus d beta alpha. And d alpha beta antisymmetric, 1/2. T alpha beta minus T beta alpha. And you can extend this to higher rank tensors. So you can just put symmetrization, and then you will be summing over all possible things, you know, changing the indices. Or you can actually do antisymmetrization, and then you are always, you know, whenever you swap two indices, you pick up a minus sign. Okay, so that will be a generalization. All right, so very good. So now the question is, how many components this object has, and how many components that object has? Okay, can you tell me? So how many? So this is 16. How many the symmetric part?
10.
Perfect. So that's probably not what we want. How many the antisymmetric part? 6. Right. So that must be the difference. Perfect. So maybe we are after the antisymmetric part, right? So we are probably after this. So this is the right piece. So let me propose an expression. Well, we call the tensor f mu nu, and we do d mu a nu. Well, I want the antisymmetric part that is a factor of two because this. Well, okay. Anyway, so let's write it like that. D nu a mu. We define this tensor here. And this better capture some information about E and B. Okay, so now that's our definition. And then you can start playing with the indices, and you can start calculating what the components are. Right. So of course this is antisymmetric. So to denote antisymmetry, sometimes people put this thing here, this like skew symmetric or whatever. And if it would put something like that. To remember that it's symmetric, okay? So this is antisymmetric. Okay, very good. So we have that. And so we can start calculating component by component. But because it's antisymmetric, of course, the diagonal has to be equal to 0. So the diagonal is equal to 0. And then if you look at the t and I components of this, you will find that this is, you know, in Cartesian coordinates, it's minus I ex minus ey minus ez. Just do it. And then, of course, it's antisymmetric, so I will have plus ex plus ey and plus ez here. And if you look at the I and j components, you will find that it actually precisely corresponds to B. So you have BZ, you have minus BY, and then you have BX, and then minus BZ, BY, and minus BX. Okay? Sorry. Let's move the zero here. Okay, so this is what you will find by calculation. And so indeed, you know, this F mu nu captures the information about your electric and magnetic fields. Okay, so the size do this, right? Okay. So the F mu nu is called Maxwell's stress tensor. Or field strength. Tensor. It's just, you know, this is the how the fields are strong. So this is the Maxwell field strength. You can also calculate, you know, what F mu nu is upstairs. So you just, you know, multiply by eta mu nu twice. Okay, so you would define F mu nu, which would be eta mu alpha, eta nu beta, F alpha beta. So remember, if you want to raise indices of an object which has, you know, more than one index, you have to raise each index separately with the eta, right? And so you would find that this is basically the same thing, except, you know, there are some minus signs are different. Okay, so you could define this tensor with indices upstairs. Okay, let me just do an exercise. We know that E and B are gauge invariant, right? So if we do the gauge transformation like so, the field strength E and B pair stay invariant. So F mu nu better be gauge invariant. And this is a simple calculation even in the 3D language, but in the 4D language is even simpler. So what we do is that we go from F mu nu to F mu nu prime, which is given by, well, okay, so we do d mu, and then we do A nu prime, so it's A nu plus D nu of lambda, and then minus D nu A mu plus D mu lambda. All right, so this is how we change these things. And so you see that there is D mu A nu minus D nu A mu, and there's plus D mu nu D nu lambda minus D nu D mu lambda. Okay. So very good. So now, of course, we are in physics. We can switch the order of partial derivatives. So this is zero, and this is the original F mu. So it is actually, you know, one line calculation to show that this object is now H invariant. And you know, in the 3D language, it's also simple, but a little bit more complicated. All right, so we have that. So now we want to write down. So we did write Maxwell equations, basically all the Maxwell's theory, in terms of A mu. It's just this equation, the Lorentz gauge, and this wave equation. So that's one way to write Maxwell's theory. So the other way to write it is in terms of E's and B's. Okay, so now Maxwell equations. And so we have two sets, right? And so, okay, let me just write. So we have the set with the sources. We have curl B minus D over DT is 4 pi J. And then we have divergence of E is 4 pi rho. Okay, so that's the equation with sources. Okay, so how does it look like, right? So how many equations do we have here?
Four.
So this is four equations. These four equations are written in terms of E and B, right? E and B is encoded in F mu nu, right? So that, now, is there a way, you know, how, okay. And so also, you know, you notice there is a derivative acting on E and B, right? So we expect that these kind of equations, well, we better, you know, combine J and rho to J mu, right? Well, 4 pi J mu. And then we need to act with a derivative on our field strength, on our F, okay? So now there's only one way to do that. Well, there's two ways, up to a minus sign. So we need to keep one index free. Okay. Now I want the right sign. So of course, if you sum over first index of F mu nu, it's minus summing over the second index of F mu nu. So let me write it this way: d nu, nu, and mu. And I think that's is a minus sign. Okay. So this is one set of equations, d nu f nu mu equals to minus 4 pi j mu. Okay, again, you can check that by plugging mu equal to t, you recover this equation, and mu equal to I, you recover that equation. Okay, so that's the first set of equations. The second set of equations is divergence of B equals to 0. And L of E plus dB over dT equals to 0. Okay, so that's the second set of equations. Again, we have four equations. Again, some kind of derivative is acting on F mu nu. So there is a derivative and there is an F. And this better be equal to 0. Okay. So now this is a little bit more complicated. So I was sort of lying to you that the only way how you can get four equations is by contracting, you know, one index here. There is yet another way in for how to get four equations, And that is, you take a derivative, and you completely anti-symmetrize. You take alpha, beta, gamma, and then you completely anti-symmetrize. So then you are asking how many objects which are totally anti-symmetric in three indices in four dimensions there are. That's given by a combinatorial number 4 over 3. Okay, so there's 4 over 3 of these, which is actually 4. So this gives you actually 4 independent equations, which are precisely give you this thing over here. So that's the second set of Maxwell equations.
Explain the anti-symmetrization a bit more.
Oh, so the anti-symmetrization is basically, it's written here for a rank 2 tensor. Okay? If I have rank 3, it will have many more terms. It will have 6 terms. What you have to do, so if you have T alpha, beta, gamma, well, there's 6 terms, so it's 1 over 6. And then you would be writing T alpha, beta, gamma. That's the first term. And then you start swapping indices to get all possible combinations of indices you can imagine. So whenever you swap two indices, if you are doing a desymmetrization, you pick up a minus sign. So for example, I swap alpha and beta. So there'll be minus T beta alpha gamma. Okay? And then I keep going. So let's swap another two, beta and gamma, for example. So then I'm picking another minus sign. So minus minus is plus. So it'll be T gamma alpha beta. And you keep going, and there should be 3 more terms. Okay, so this is how you do that. Okay. Yes.
Is this the same as contracting with the Lovici meter tensor?
Mm-hmm. Very good. So because you started it, I will finish it. So what you can do is you can introduce, you know, 4D Lovici meter tensor. Epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, which is totally anti-symmetric in all indices. And it's equal to, you know, 1 if it's epsilon t x y z. Epsilon t x y z is equal to 1, and then you get, you know, once you, and then if you have two same indices, 2 and more same indices, then it's equal to 0. So if you have all indices distinct, then you define epsilon txyz equal to 1. And then you get all other ones which are non-trivial. For example, epsilon x t y z will be minus 1, and so on. Yes?
So when we were writing this out with the like normally when you swap indices, especially if you're defining this with the Lovici-Vita tensor,
yes,
normally you have to like just swap adjacent ones and see and kind of. And each time, then you get the minus sign. But here, you just swapped the n to. Oh, maybe that's okay because you can swap them.
Yeah. You can do it, you know, term by term.
Yeah.
But remember, whenever you're swapping two indices, you just get a minus.
But here, we would swap it twice, which would mean it would be a plus sign, but it would be it wouldn't be different from the second term, like the sign.
Say it again.
Should be minus.
So this one here, why should it be minus?
Because you'd have to swap the gamma with the, oh no, you'd have to.
You have to do it twice, right? So for example, from this one, right? So what I'm doing is that, well,
oh, no.
I'm moving gamma to the front, so I'm swapping with beta and then swapping with alpha.
Yeah.
And then, so you have to do it twice, and then you get a plus.
Yeah.
Yes?
Is the 4D Lovici-Vita tensor another like determinant of deltas?
Yes, exactly. So you can think about it like, yeah.
Does the symmetric part of the T has any meaning?
The symmetric part of, you know, of this thing here, I'm not sure. I don't know. So typically symmetric parts are bad. That's the general rule. So the only exception is gravity, which is described by the metric. But you know, anti-symmetric tensor fields much simpler. Okay, you can define nice derivatives of them. They have the gauge symmetry and so on. So you know, anti-symmetric tensor fields much nicer and in some sense more fundamental than the symmetric ones. Okay.
Fundamental is too heavy, but.
Well, typically, you know, what happens? Well, why I'm saying more fundamental, right? Is for example, I take, you know, I take f mu nu. Well, that's anti-symmetric. Well, then I construct object like this. Well, that was stupid. Alpha, and then nu, right? So then this thing here will be symmetric. P mu nu, right? So this guy is symmetric. This is anti-symmetric. But we can say that the symmetric tensor is just a square root of f. Right, and so that's true for many, many things. So typically, you can get, you know, symmetric tensor fields as a square of some more fundamental anti-symmetric tensor field. Okay, I didn't say anything. Okay, so this I didn't say that. Okay, but it's true.
All anti-symmetric tensors will have a gauge symmetry.
Well, is that true? I don't know. Typically. Yeah, I think so.
Because it gets cancelled if we write the gauge.
Yeah. So you know, in the form, in the language of forms, you have arbitrary anti-symmetric tensor omega, right? And you just add d of lambda, whatever that means, right? And if your field strength is like d of omega is your field strength, then of course d square of lambda will be zero. So that will be true. Okay, so we have this object here for the Levi-Civita tensor. It's like 3D1, but now you have included time as well. Yes?
I can't read. What does it say after the second?
Well, this is a bad thing. So what I want to say is that, you know, this is zero whenever you have two repeated indices or three or four, right? Now, it's only non-trivial if you have all distinct indices. So there must be somewhere T, X, Y, and Z, okay? So now you define epsilon t x y and z in that order to be plus one, and then once you start, you know, it's anti-symmetric. So once you start, you know, permutating these indices, then you get a minus sign sometimes and whatever. Okay. And so then what you define is a Hodge dual of f mu nu, and it's written as that star of f mu nu. And then it's given by 1/2 epsilon nu kappa lambda f kappa lambda. So that's a definition. You use this, you know, Levi-Civita tensor to define a Hodge dual of f alpha beta, and you just define it this way. Okay, you just sum over all these indices. Yes?
What's the general definition of like a Hodge dual for like any ordered tensor?
Yeah, you would always contract all the indices of the tensor with epsilon, and whatever is left is your new tensor. So here we are lucky that, you know, we started with an object which has two indices here, and we end up with an object which has two indices here. Okay? But if I, for example, define okay, I wanted to do this for a vector or a covector or whatever. So then I would have epsilon mu nu kappa lambda v lambda, right? And so you are summing over one index, so that will be 1/1. Here we are summing over two indices, so it's 1/2. If you're summing over three indices, it will be 1/3, and so on. But now it's obvious that, you know, this v would have three indices, mu nu kappa. Right, so you know, then, you know, the Hodge dual is a different rank tensor than you started with.
So can you only go up to like four indices?
What do you think?
I can't define it with like a higher order Lovich beta tensor or higher dimensional.
So this object here has four indices in four dimensions. If you go to higher dimensions, of course, it will have many more indices. It has that many indices as you have number of dimensions. Of course, you know, in higher dimensions, you would have t, x1, x2, x3, x4, xn, whatever, right? So then your epsilon would be much, much bigger. Okay, so we have that. And so then we can look at your equation here. And we can just multiply it by the tensor, okay? So what we do is that we have d alpha f beta gamma anti-symmetrization, and we just multiply it by epsilon mu alpha beta gamma, basically constructing a Hodge tool of the whole equation. So now we are constructing, you know, and that will be 1 over 3 factorial, because we are summing over three indices. But of course, the original equation was equal to 0, so this is still equal to 0. All the equations were equal to 0. But then look at this, right? So this guy here is already antisymmetric in alpha, beta, and gamma, right? What it means is that I don't need the antisymmetrization here. Okay, that's a subtle point. Okay, let me explain it. So let's see, I have a tensor which is symmetric, so symmetric in alpha and beta, and then it's multiplied by a tensor which is antisymmetric in alpha and beta. Well, what is this equal to? What do you think? Huh? It must be equal to 0. Why? Is this obvious to everybody? Don't be shy. Okay. So what it means is that if I have a more general tensor alpha beta here, f alpha beta here, okay, because this guy is antisymmetric, only the antisymmetric part of t will contribute, because the symmetric times that would be 0. So it is the same thing as t alpha beta f alpha beta, right? So it's the same thing, because the symmetric part will always be 0. Okay, so if I delete this bracket here, nothing changes, because the symmetric part of this will be killed by the antisymmetric part of that. So I can also do this, because this epsilon already takes care of my antisymmetrization. Okay, very good. So that's beautiful. 1 over 3 factorial, still 0, right? So that's still 0. Okay. So now epsilon, what is epsilon? It's either 0 or 1. Okay. So I can pull it inside the derivative. Well, certainly I can. Right? It's just differentiating 0 doesn't change anything. So my equation now becomes d alpha epsilon mu alpha beta gamma f beta gamma equals to 0. Well, this d alpha x on the whole thing. Right? But then what you see inside is up to a factor 1 over 2 is the Hodge dual of f. Okay? So we just arrived at an equation that the second set of Maxwell equations, so second set, can also be written as d alpha of f of star. And then I'm getting star f mu alpha, but it's equal to 0, so I can swap the indices. Why not? So star f alpha beta equals to 0. Okay. Everybody happy with this derivation? And so then you see that Maxwell equations can be written in very, very symmetric form. They can be written as d mu f mu nu equals to minus 4 pi j nu. And d mu of star of f mu nu equals to 0. So that's your Maxwell equations. But I said symmetric form, well, they would be symmetric if j were 0. They will look very, very symmetric. J is not 0. this equation, well, what is this equation? One of these equations is divergence of B equals zero. So basically, it's the absence of the magnetic monopoles. And if I, you know, define J magnetic mu to be rho magnetic J magnetic, then your then of course this thing here will appear here. So the generalization of this will be d mu star f mu nu is to minus 4 pi j m mu nu. And so that will be a generalization of your Maxwell equation, and that will make these equations completely symmetric. Okay, but it's only if you had magnetic monopoles. We know that we don't. At least there is no evidence that we do. And so that's why this equation is a little bit anti-symmetric with respect to that one. There is no current on the right-hand side. Yes?
Last time you had told us that out of all the Maxwell equations, two of them are just identity. So if we have magnetic monopole, then also the last equation will be an identity.
Aha. What do you think? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you know, if you had the magnetic monopoles, So the statement is, you know, this equation is an identity which is satisfied if you. Okay. I am mixing two things. So there's two equations, right? One is divergence of E equals to rho, and one is divergence of B equal to zero. So these two things are initial conditions for the rest of the equations. Each of these equations is combined in one set of these equations. This one has the rho part, and this one has the divergence of B equal to zero part. So that's one statement. Okay, so you basically put the initial conditions in both. You put the initial conditions here, and you put the initial conditions there as well. That was not your question, right? Your question was, say, identity, what do you mean identity?
We could derive the other two equations using the...
Oh, very good. So when you go to the four potentials, very good. Thank you. So then we had, so that was one statement. The second statement was that we could solve, you know, four Maxwell equations by simply saying that f mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, okay? So we could solve that by introducing the potential phi and a, right? So then the question is, which set of these equations is automatically solved when you set this? Which set?
Del dot b is equals to.
Yeah, it's this one here. Okay, so this is automatically done in, you know, d mu star f mu nu equal to zero. Of course, if you had magnetic monopoles, this wouldn't be really true, right? And because otherwise you would get zero always, but you cannot if you have magnetic current. So in that case, you know, this wouldn't be true. You know, some people introduce another vector potential for the magnetic things and so on, then it gets complicated. But yeah.
Why do you call Levi-Civita tensor?
Sorry, is.
Levi-Civita tensor?
Oh, because there is like 3D Levi-Civita, which is G epsilon ijk, which you know from three dimensions, and that's called Levi-Civita tensor.
Like, do you mean we can contract it with like eta mu nu or g mu nu, and then we still get like proper transformation after like Lorentz transformation?
Yeah. So in special relativity, this is indeed what is it? Epsilon. Somewhere it's epsilon there. It is indeed a tensor. So it transforms nicely as an object with four indices under Lorentz transformations. In general relativity, you will find that it's a pseudo tensor. It's not really a tensor. It's almost a tensor, but not quite. And you will see that. Okay. So but in special relativity, it is a tensor. All right. So we have Maxwell equations written in this form, written in the a mu form. I still have a little bit piece of blackboard here left. And we know that there is also a Lorentz force. To complete our theory, we not only have the field equations, but we also have the equations of motion for the matter, right? So the Lorentz force, or something like F is whatever, Q, or let's call it E plus B cross B, right? So that was our Lorentz force. Okay, so it's super simple to generalize this to this language. So the force now has to be a space-time force. So we have to replace Fi with F mu. Okay. Then E is whatever it needs to be, well, E. Okay. And then if you look at the right-hand side, right? So the right-hand side has E and B in it. Okay. We know that E and B are combined in F mu nu. So there must be somewhere F mu nu. It's different F than that F. Okay. And then there is the velocity. Okay. And the right-hand side is sort of linear in the velocity. So we will see next lecture that the velocity gets promoted to the four velocity. Okay, so U, which will contain as a special part, V. And so what else it can be is up to a sign, F mu nu, U nu, we need to have four equations. So that's the only possibility how we can write it down, up to a sign. So that's your Lorentz force. But of course, this thing here contains an extra equation. It contains an equation where I can set mu equal to t. Right? So then it's up to you to investigate what is the meaning of this equation for mu equal to t. So it, for mu equal to I, it better reduces to this one. For mu equal to t, we are getting some extra knowledge. Okay. So, but you know, this is what it has to be. So that's the Lorentz law. Lorentz force. Everybody happy?
Yeah.
Ah, that's good. perfect. So very good. So we have rewritten our Maxwell's theory in this four index notation. I still haven't proved that the Maxwell theory is invariant under Lorentz transformations. I will start this today and finish it what the Lorentz transformations are tomorrow. Just let's do a first look at Lorentz transformations. Okay. And so what these Lorentz transformations will be is that they are transformations of coordinates. So we typically start with a nice inertial system with my Cartesian coordinates. So we have coordinates t, x, y, and z. And then we are asking, you know, what kind of new coordinates I can have so that still physics is nice in these coordinates, right? So we know that for the Newton's laws, it will be the Galilean transformations, right? So we know that if you are in an inertial system, your force law of Newton is F equal to ma, where F is the true force, and then ma is your acceleration. And this will be true in an inertial frame. So now you're asking, well, is this nice law still valid in any other frame? And the answer is, it will be still valid in the frames which are connected by the Galilean transformations. If you start doing outside of the Galilean transformations, you start rotating things, accelerating things, and so on, your F equal to ma is no longer nice. You start picking up inertial forces on the right-hand side. You start picking up Coriolis force. You start picking up, I don't know, centrifugal force, and so on. right? So F equal to ma is only nice in inertial systems, and these inertial systems are connected with Galilean transformation. So now the nice form of the Maxwell equations, let's say in Cartesian coordinates, as we are writing it here, or the wave equation, whatever, is valid in the inertial frame. Now we are asking what kind of transformations we can have, what kind of systems, so that this is still the same, still looks the same. Okay. So for this purpose, we consider linear transformations. Linear transformation. Well, it has to be linear, because if it's anything else, it's bad. Okay. So only the linear transformations have always inversion. They don't have any singular points. They don't screw up other things, right? So if you start thinking about general coordinate transformations, you typically introduce, you know, some singularities and coordinate singularities and also something like that. So it has to be linear transformation. So what we are doing is that we are going from x mu to x mu prime. And because it's linear, we take a constant matrix and x nu. So this is a constant matrix. You could also add, you know, plus b mu, then you would be doing Poincaré transformations. But let's not do that, OK? So we have that. And of course, we can also go the other way around. We can go from x mu prime to, you know, we can do the inversion. So this will be equivalent to doing the inverse transformation. So going from x mu prime to x mu, and this will be given by the inverse matrix, x nu prime. And because it's an inverse matrix, let me call it lambda tilde. And of course, what I require is that lambda tilde equal to 1 equal to lambda tilde equal to lambda. All right, so this is an inverse matrix to that one here. OK, so then you may be also asking, so this is how the coordinates will transform. So I can go this way, or I can go the way back. And you know, just this is an inverse transformation. You can also ask, you know, how my derivatives, for example, change. So this is d over dx mu prime. And by using the chain rule, this is equal to dx nu over dx mu prime d over dx nu. So now dx nu over dx mu prime, I'm looking at this thing here. So now if I differentiate x nu with respect to x mu prime, I'll pick up this matrix here. So this will be lambda tilde nu mu d nu. OK. So again, this is a prototype of a covector, how the covector transforms under the Lorentz transformations. So whenever you would have an object omega mu prime, it will simply transform in this way. Omega nu. So that's how the covectors transform. So they transform with respect to this inverse matrix lambda. So now I could cheat and I could say, well, x mu is a vector. And so the vectors will transform according to normal lambda, not lambda tilde, but according to lambda. This will be very confusing. The reason why it's confusing is that you can think about the coordinates x mu as a vector only in special relativity. Only in special relativity, this will sort of be a vector. But in general relativity, it's not true. Because in general relativity, you can transform coordinates whatever, however you want. And that wouldn't be a nice transformation for the vectors. So let's do something else. So let's take a prototype of a vector, which will be our vector potential A mu. So prototype of a vector of a vector is our A mu. And to derive how this A mu transforms is that, well, we want that our equations keep the same form in the new inertial frame, okay? So that's precisely what we wanted from the Newton's theory. We want that now in special relativity as well. So let's take the Lorentz gauge condition. So that's our Lorentz gauge condition, A mu, A mu. And it better has exactly the same form as if I write it in my new frame. Okay. But then I know how my d mu prime transforms. So it is given by lambda tilde nu mu d nu. So that's how my that's my d mu prime. And then a prime mu, right? But I want this to be equal to that, d mu a mu, okay? So the only possibility is that this thing here transforms with respect to lambda, and then that lambda somehow miraculously cancels this lambda tilde, okay? So then you see that, you know, this will be true if we have d nu, and then we have this lambda tilde nu mu, and then lambda mu alpha a alpha mu alpha, yeah. And these two are inverse, so they give me delta nu alpha. So this will be really d nu d alpha a alpha or d nu a nu. So you see that the only possibility, you know, how to make, you know, this is that the a has to transform in this way. Okay. So now we have transformation of vectors. Just v mu is lambda mu nu v nu. Okay. This is how vectors transform. Okay. So you can derive that by requiring that, you know, this Lorentz gauge condition looks the same in our new inertial frame. Questions? Oh no. Why am I so slow? So now the most important equation I want to derive today is how, you know, what is really how the Lorentz transformation is defined. So at this point, it's just, you know, a linear transformation. There's a matrix lambda here. And we know how, you know, the things transform, how the vectors transform if you do the transformation of coordinates like that. But we still don't know what the lambda has to be, what kind of conditions it has to satisfy. And you can derive that by, again, requiring that your Maxwell equations remain invariant in the inertial frame. And so we have seen that one nice form of the Maxwell equations, you can do it for any form, but is the box equation for A mu. So we had the equation box on A mu is, well, let's put it equal to zero, doesn't matter. So no sources. We want this equation to look the same in any inertial frame. Okay, so our equation is box on A mu is eta alpha beta d alpha d beta on A mu. That's what our equation is. Or it will be more convenient. We can put the indices down and write it with this strange derivative upstairs, d alpha d beta a mu. Okay, so now we want this to look the same in the you know, in the other frame. Okay, so then we would have eta alpha beta prime d prime alpha d beta prime a mu. After the transformation, but this will be only the same when the eta alpha beta prime is the same as eta alpha beta, requiring the form invariance of equations. Okay. So if this is to be eta alpha beta, and then I know how these guys transform, I already derived that. So if it were normal derivative, is index downstairs, it would transform according to lambda tilde. But now, because I raise the index, I transform with respect to lambda. Okay. So now this is lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta d gamma d delta, whatever the a is. Well, I'm just kidding, the a is not important. Okay, so we have that. And now you see, you want to compare, well, I chose stupid indices. Anyway, so this, yeah, comparing with that, okay? Sorry, with that. So it's better be true. Well, I can compare that if I have the same index alpha and beta in the derivatives here. Well, that will require some work. OK, let's do it. So we have that eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. I can rename the indices to gamma and delta. So we'll have eta gamma delta d gamma d delta. And this better be equal to this thing here. Eta alpha beta lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta d gamma d delta. Sorry, I'm just taking a lot of time to do that. So now you see, you can compare directly the two terms, and it means that this has to be equal to that. Okay, and so you have the transformation of the metric as eta gamma delta is equal to eta alpha beta lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta. So if your equations are to be the same, are to have the same form in the new inertial frame, your Lorentz transformation matrix has to satisfy this equation. And this equation is typically, you know, used as a starting point for, you know, defining what the Lorentz transformation means. And this is like a definition transformation. Okay, you can also write it.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. So does this equal zero? Because at the top.
Yeah, it will be equal to zero. Yes.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so you can put the j mu there if you want, and you know the j. I am carrying this a mu for the right, and the side would be the j mu here, right? So the a mu would change somehow. It would transform as a vector under the Lorentz transformation. Right, so I would have an extra matrix here with which how the A mu would transform, and the same thing for the J mu. But basically, what I need to know is how the box operator transforms.
Oh.
Right, so it's, you know, so the box operator. Well, let's just do it like that. Okay.
Okay. So we're just looking at the box operator. Yeah. Otherwise, we could have like anything equals anything because.
Yeah. So let's just look at the box operator, and the box operator has to remain you know, the form of the box operator has to remain invariant under the Lorentz transformation. Sorry, yeah, this will be easier, right? So okay. So by the way, you know, this thing here is just, you know, if I write it as a matrix, this guy is an eta, so you can write this as a eta equals to lambda transpose eta lambda, which looks very much like 1 equals to OTO. So this would be rotations. So the rotation matrix would be, again, a linear transformation of coordinates, of spatial coordinates, which would satisfy OTO is equal to 1. Well, we know that eta is almost 1, except in the time direction. And of course, you know, so this thing here definitely contains rotations as well in the spatial part, but it also contains something interesting in the time direction. Questions? If not, let me very quickly, I still have 5 minutes or so, to tell you what is really different in Newton or, you know, in Galilean case and what, from the special relativity. And you all know the result. The result is that we basically remove the absolute time with something relative and whatever. But really, what is the most important difference is the existence of the light cone in the Minkowski space-time. And so the space-time itself is very, very different in the Newtonian and in the Minkowski picture. So V space-time and causal structure . So of course, the space-time, you know, consists of events. So we have events. Which are points of space, points in space, of space in an instant of time. So, you know, you have a point P, which is an event in the space-time. And of course, that point P is characterized by the spatial coordinates where, but also by time, when it happened, right? So where and when. T and X, OK? So now, funny thing is that if you start having more than one point, one event in the space-time, okay, and so let's say I have two. So having p and q events in the space-time, you may be asking questions like, is it possible to go from p to q or from q to p and whatever, right? And so then you can distinguish three possibilities. So the possibility number one is that can an observer can go from U to P. Okay, so basically, you know, the observer, you know, sees Q, but then later on he said he can see P as well. So then, of course, the Q is to the past of P. Q is to the past of P. The other way, well, the second possibility is reverse possibility, right? So it is possible to go from P to Q. So then you would say that Q would be to the future of P, right? The second would be can go from P to Q. And then Q is to the future of P. So that's the second possibility. But the most interesting one is the third possibility, is that observer cannot see balls and cubes simultaneously, cannot see them. Observer can never see balls, U and P. Okay. And so that's what really distinguishes the Newtonian spacetime from the Minkowski spacetime. So in the Newton case, this set of events which can never be observed simultaneously, well, can never be observed by a single observer, they are defined by the surfaces of simultaneity. I have T and X. So this is a 3D surface. 3D surface of simultaneity. Okay. And so if you have P, in that surface, then all Qs, which that observer will never be able to see, are in that surface, in the 3D surface, right? So spans 3. Spans the set of points in 3, right? On the other hand, and that's a surface of constant time. So this is a constant time. Constant time. And this time is absolute, right? So it doesn't matter how the observer moves or whatever. So simply, if the observer is at the point P, this surface remains the same no matter, it's independent of the motion of the observer. Okay? Constant time and whatever. On the other hand, everything which lies, which has bigger T than this thing here, is the future. And it doesn't matter how far the Q is, right? There's an instantaneous action. So there's an infinite propagation of information, if you want. So no matter how far the Q is, if it's at later time, the observer can still see it. Okay? So anything which is, above that surface is the future, and anything which is below that surface is the past. Okay, so that's the Newtonian spacetime. Okay, so now the spacetime in relativity, special relativity. We know that if you have P, what's really important and what can be reached is actually inside the light cone. So there's a light cone structure. And then, what lies inside the light cone is the future. What lies in the past light cone is the past. This is the light cone. And then the surfaces of simultaneity are no longer 3D surfaces, but they basically fill everything else. Okay? It's a now 4D region, which is spanned by the surfaces of simultaneity, and they depend on the motion of the observer. Okay, so this is called space-like related events. and they can never be observed by the observer at P if they lie outside of the light column. Okay? And so here, this thing is a 4D set, not a 3D one. So here, what you could not see was just this, surface of just one slice at a given time. But here, it's all these slices here, like that, like that, like that. They will never be able, whatever is on that slice, will never, be able to interact with our observer P. And so this is the main difference between special relativity and Newtonian physics. It's not that the transformations are different. Well, they are different, but only slightly. And the Lorentz transformation is almost Galilean transformation, right? But what is really, really different is this thing here. And so that's the main thing. I still have 1 minute. So general relativity is still remains true, but only locally. Okay, so let me formulate it as a remark. So basically, it's a big step from Newton to special relativity, but from special relativity to general relativity, it's only a small step, which just it's just from 1905 to 1915, right? Well, if he hadn't had Einstein, it would never be probably. Okay, so remark. In general relativity, the light cone structure, still true. But only locally. What it means is that you will have your space-time, and at each point of that space-time, around that point, there will be a small light cone, which will tell you what is the future, what is the past, and where you cannot go, right? But this will be only true in the close neighborhood of that point P. And then as you start moving into some other points, it may happen that this light cone sort of gets twisted. And it can turn around and it can, So one example is your favorite closed time like curves where you can do time travel and so on, and you can kill your grandfather. It can happen that this thing here sort of twists like that. So locally you would always have the light cone structure. And you would always have to travel within the light cone. Right? But it may happen that the curvature of the space-time causes the fact that actually, this in the end, you will actually come up here again. And so this is how you have to do. So this is possible. This will be an example of a closed time-like curve. Where you can affect your past. And it's not a science fiction. It really exists. And there are many important space times in general relativity which will have that. And so, for example, one very important is the one which describes black hole, rotating black hole. So if you have Kerr metric, then inside the Kerr metric, you have regions which have closed time-like curves. And so sort of really the cones get twisted like that, and you can affect your past. Okay, so this is possible. Possible, maybe. But certainly many, exact and nice space-times still have these things. But the very existence of the black hole basically relies on the fact that the light cone gets twisted. So if you have black hole, then you know that there is some miraculous radius, the radius of the black hole, black hole radius here, time and space. And you know that if you are very, very far away from the black hole, the light cones look As usual, you have basically Minkowski. But as you are getting closer and closer to that, you know, black hole horizon, these light cones get twisted and they turn. Similar turning there, they turn towards here. So if you are on the black hole horizon, then the only possibility is that you travel inside here. Okay? So basically the black hole horizon is a region where from, you know, if you travel to your future, or if you are, you know, light, it moves on the light cone, your radius is always decreasing. Okay? So this is how the light cone gets twisted. And then, you know, inside the black hole, it would even look like this. And so that's why once you cross the horizon of the black hole, you have to necessarily go to r equal to zero. But r equal to zero is really, really bad for you because there is a singularity. And basically it will crash you and then you will end up there. Okay? So but you know, remember that you know, this light cone structure is true in general relativity as well. Except now, you know, these locally, the light cones actually, you know, they still look like light cones locally, but they can, you know, arbitrarily twist around in space time. Questions? Singularity is bad. And that's bad. Okay. Questions? Well, it's bad anyway, right? That's right. So you know, in general relativity, what happens is that at singularity at r equal to zero, this is not part of your manifold. Something's bad. Some bad things happen. But even as you are getting close to the singularity, the tidal forces, which are the forces which try to, you know, squeeze you and tear you up and whatever, they grow infinite. Okay, so even if you don't need to necessarily reach r equal to zero, but even, you know, close to r equal to zero, it will just, you know, tear you to parts. Okay, so that's bad. Yeah, yeah. So it's like a white hole. Why is it a white hole?
There are some kind of Rose diagrams in which you go into the black hole and you come out of the black hole in another sort of quote unquote universe.
This is not a Penrose diagram. This is just T and R direction. And all I'm saying is that the light cones look as we know them, like pointing up far away, but they sort of twist around a little bit. And then they twist a lot. They are twisted a lot. They still look like 45 degrees, 45 degrees. It doesn't look like that, but it's 45, 45 degrees. But locally, in right coordinates. But the future simply, you know, the light cone gets twisted into that direction. So if, you know, from here, I cannot travel outside. I have to always travel to the future, right? So I have to travel within the light cone. So I can never go outside of the black hole. If I'm here, I always have to travel inside. That's what the black hole horizon is, right? And then if I'm even further inside, the light cone actually still keeps twisting. And so I have to necessarily travel to where it's r equal to zero if I travel to the future.
So only space-time curvature causes light cones to change angle?
Well, here it's the space-time curvature, but I am not sure.
Like what
I mean,
Lorentz transformations wouldn't change the shape of that.
So yeah, exactly. Very good. So the Lorentz transformations, they preserve the Minkowski space-time as we know it. So they will not do anything with this. So here, the light cone is global. It's true everywhere in the space-time, right? So you will draw the same light cone in every point of your space-time, and the Minkowski transformation cannot prevent that.
Would this be because we're not in an inertial reference frame, or like we are accelerating?
That's precisely right. Yeah, that's precisely right. So the black hole, you know, has gravity, gravitational field, and you can think about it as equivalent to acceleration. So yeah, that will be like an acceleration.
Because, yeah, like you can't really like, I don't know. People, I've been taught speculatively where you can't talk about accelerating reference frames and stuff, but that's just for GE
GR, but.
Well, yes, you can. Okay, let me stop here.